Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The Sierra Leone police summoned the former president of Sierra Leone, Anesai Kuruma, to help with investigations into November 26th, failed coup in Sierra Leone.
Sierra Leone's government denies report that former president Anesai Kuruma is under house arrest. We'll have details.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres deployed the rarely used Article 99 of the UN Charter this week to seek a ceasefire to prevent what he says is a catastrophe.
The United Nations Security Council votes on a resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza.
So our demand is that these are prisoners of conscience and therefore they should be released without any further ado.
And the leader of the minority in the Ugandan parliament calls for the unconditional release of all political prisoners. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leone's Minister for Information and Civic Education says former President Anesai Kuruma is cooperating with the police who are investigating the recent coup attempt. Chen Oba also denied media reports that he is under house arrest due to increased security at his residence in the capital, Freetown. He says the former president requested increased security after Kuruma's first day of interrogation at the Criminal Investigation Department of the police. Kuruma was also at the police station on Saturday for another round of interrogation. For the latest development into the inquiry into what the government describes as an attempted coup, I reach Information and Civic Education Minister Chen Oba.
The Sierra Leone police summoned the former president of Sierra Leone, Anesai Kuruma, to help with the investigations into the November 26th failed coup in Sierra Leone. The former president complied with the summons. He showed up at the police headquarters yesterday. He was they started the process of these interrogations and questioning. They ended by mutual consent. He asked he had to go take his medications, and they agreed that the interrogations will continue. So these were just preliminary set of questions at this point. And he went home. He had asked as well for additional security to be provided. And of course, the state continues to do that, which is our responsibility. So as far as we're concerned, we know that he's cooperating at this minute, and the investigations will continue. And my understanding is that they will continue questioning him today as well.
Did the former president say the reason why he needed the security enhancement for which the government provided?
Well, as we know now, quite a number of his guards, current and former, were involved in the planning and execution of the failed attempted coup of November 26th. And some of them are currently helping the police with investigation. Two of them suffered fatal injuries on the day of the attack. And it is possible that the former president just wants additional security from the state. And he was moving from Makeni, where he's normally based, to be based in Freetown. So we don't, again, speculate on his intentions. What we know is that the state's responsibility is to ensure that everybody is safe, including obviously a former president. So whatever we can do, we'll continue to do that.
I know you can't tell me the details of the ongoing investigation into the November 26 attack, but how is the process moving forward so far? Because some critics are saying that it appears to be a witch hunt, politically motivated, and some opposition leaders have been arrested, and it seems to be targeting some group of people, or tribal people for that matter. How do you respond to that?
The president of Sierra Leone, His Excellency Julius Maada Bello, has been very clear. This is an investigation that will follow strictly the rule of law. We will follow the evidence. Nobody's protected because of their status. Nobody's exempted because of their status either. We've been very transparent. We published as much as we can the names of all those who are on the wanted list, everybody who's been arrested, everybody who's been questioned. They have been questioned with their lawyers. It's been an incredibly transparent process. And on this insinuations of targeting, we lost 21 Sierra Leoneans. 18 servicemen were buried at a public funeral, where their children, their family members, their parents were there in tears, in pain, that their children who left home that day, their fathers who left home to go do their job, didn't come home because some people who wanted to take power through unconstitutional means decided to attack them, and they pay the ultimate tax. That's what we are focused on, is to ensure that those people are brought to justice in the name of those that have been killed and in the name of our democracy, which is why we will stick to the fact and we will abide by the rule of law.
Chen Oba is Sierra Leone's Minister for Information and Civic Education. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In Nigeria, a leading human rights defender is calling on the government to immediately launch an impartial investigation into the bombing of a Kaduna state village that left at least 85 dead and many injured. It comes after the Nigerian military expressed regret over what it says was a mistake in a drone strike that accidentally led to the deaths and injury. But Attorney Douglas Ogbankwa is calling for resignations from among the top leadership of the military. Both the UN Human Rights Commission and Amnesty International have condemned the bombing and are calling for an inquiry. It also comes as civil society is expressing outrage over the bombing. Attorney Douglas Ogbankwa tells me that the military leadership must be held responsible for what he says is a costly mistake.
I would say that it's completely unacceptable. It's serious crimes right now. We would have had people resigning and also some people being taken into custody, you know, for what appears to be an avoidable killings of innocent people. The talk by the military that it was a mistake leaves much to be desired. As a matter of fact, you know, when something is done once, it could be a mistake, but once it's done twice, it appears to be something that I wouldn't know how to describe it. But I just need to say that the government has to take proactive steps to stem the tension that is generating right now. I understand protests are going on even at the National Assembly. We want to say that Nigerian lives must matter to the Nigerian government. To this end, government must put in place measures to bring about an inquiry to find out what really happened.
Do you think the demand for heads to roll or some top officials of the military to go will solve the problem?
It's very important that in trying to situate the dynamics of Nigerian security architecture, we must know that we have competent persons in charge of our security architecture. And there is no other way to describe the avoidable killings that cost the lives of 85 people in Kaduna State other than incompetence. And such level of incompetence stems from a poor leadership in the chain of command. So it is important that the Nigerian government takes very bold steps. They may be painful, but bold steps that would send a message to those in charge of our security architecture that this is no longer business as usual.
The United Nations is calling for an independent and thorough investigation. Amnesty International is also saying that the bombing is unacceptable and that the persistent unlawful killings of civilians by military airstrikes, accusing literally the Nigerian military of cover-up, a demand that justice be served on the matter. Is this the feeling on the ground in Nigeria?
Yeah, absolutely right, Peter. Nigerians are outraged at this level of, military misadventure, so to speak. I do not know of any kind of military operations against the Boko Haram or any insurgent group in the last 2 years that have claimed at Usoft 85 or more victims. So it does appear as if the military that is supposed to protect its people and protect the territorial integrity of Nigeria, and also protect Nigerians, seem to have taken his weapon against his own people. And so it is very important that government should, first of all, call to identify the victims, after which they should reach out to their families for condolences, and while those condolences are ongoing, adequate compensation. And you know, the life cannot be, you cannot put a quantum on life.
They are suggesting that perhaps if the military has owned that, yet the Nigerian population wants the same military to launch offensive again and defeat Boko Haram, and there's a problem, which they admit there's a problem, they would do better. Why are they being severely being bashed.
Well, you need to understand that there was a religious festival going on. So the religion in Nigeria is even more tenuous than tribalism. You know, so people would read all manner of meanings to what took place, you know, on that particular day. And also, you cannot also beat a child and you don't expect the child to cry. These people are genuinely aggrieved. They've lost their loved ones. At this point in time, this is not a time to be doing back and forth. It is actually a time to try and assuage their feelings.
Attorney Douglas Ogbankwa is a leading human rights defender. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Hi, I'm Larry London from Border Crossings. Welcome to VOA throughout Africa. We're glad you're with us. And I want to remind you, we've got our Tuesday Spotlight Artist of the Week every week on Tuesdays. And it starts in December. December 12th, Babyface, who's nominated for so many Grammy Awards. He's had 26 number one songs. It was such a thrill to talk to Babyface. And you can hear that conversation on December 12th at 1500 Universal on Border Crossings here on The Voice of America.
The United Nations Security Council met on Friday to vote on an Arab-sponsored resolution that called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. 13 countries voted in favor of the resolution, but it failed when the United States vetoed it. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
As Israel continues to bombard Gaza, an Israeli airstrike in Khan Yunis Thursday reportedly hit a residential block, killing an unknown number of people and injuring others. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres deployed the rarely used Article 99 of the UN Charter this week to seek a ceasefire to prevent what he says is a catastrophe with a potentially irreversible impact on the Palestinian people and the entire Middle East.
Some 130 hostages are still held captive, and I call for their immediate and unconditional release, as well as their humane treatment and visits from the international community of the Red Cross until they are freed. At the same time, the brutality perpetrated by Hamas can never justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people.
Robert Wood, the U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the United Nations, also spoke Friday.
We do not support calls for an immediate ceasefire. This would only plant the seeds for the next war because Hamas has no desire to see a durable peace.
The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says 350 people were killed in the enclave in 24 hours, bringing the total Palestinian death toll to more than 17,000 people. During a joint press conference with his British counterpart Thursday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he told Israeli leaders during a recent visit to the region that the suffering inflicted on Palestinian civilians in the north must not be repeated in Israel's military offensive now going on in the south.
It remains imperative that Israel put a premium on civilian protection. And there does remain a gap between exactly what I said when I was there, the intent to protect civilians, and the actual results that we're seeing on the ground.
In Tel Aviv late Thursday, families of Israeli hostages attended a candle lighting ceremony for the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, lighting a special 138-candle menorah, representing the 138 hostages still being held captive by Hamas. Israel says that its operations are necessary to target the U.S.-designated terror group, and that it is taking precautions to avoid civilian deaths, but that Hamas uses civilians as human shields. Hamas attacked Israel on October 7, killing some 1,200 people and taking about 240 hostages, around 100 of whom have been released. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
In Dubai, a prominent African environmental conservationist is calling for an end to deforestation. Professor Lee White is a former minister for water, forests, the sea and environment in Gabon. He also talks about the green industrialization opportunity in Africa and why he thinks the U.S. should get involved. His comments come after the head of the U.N. Climate Summit calls on world leaders to implement the accord aimed at resolving global warming. For more on the ongoing COP28 Climate Summit, I reached Professor Lee White in Dubai via Skype.
You know, 15 years ago, when we started talking about REDD+ and reducing emissions, Africa was absorbing probably about 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year. And in the 15 years, we've just been talking about saving forests. We haven't actually done it. We've lost probably over a billion of those tons. So if you look at deforestation across West Africa and across Central Africa, we're at the point where Africa is probably only absorbing about, at least the African rainforest, about 400 or 500 million tons of CO2. Still important. That's still 0.5% of global emissions. But we're losing headway. We're not gaining headway. We're not stabilizing the forests. We're losing more and more forests. And we have to make a very concerted effort over the coming 5 to 10 years to reverse that process, because the African rainforest could be hugely positive for the future of the planet.
Well, Professor White, talk to me about the green industrialization opportunity on the continent and the prospects for the U.S. to get involved. And do you think the U.S. should even get involved in the first place?
So I think U.S. definitely should be looking to get involved in these carbon positive industries in Africa. As we look at deforestation in Africa, a lot of it is about agriculture. And unfortunately, a lot of it is slash and burn agriculture, which is a technology that dates back to 600 BC, 600 years before Jesus, and has not been modernized since. And so there needs to be a sort of agricultural revolution in Africa where we modernize these prehistoric farming techniques with modern tropical agriculture that can be 20 times more productive and can be carbon positive. And so we can create 20 times more food, 20 times more money, as well as creating carbon credits.
Talk to me about Gabon's model of conservatism that you think is replicable in other parts of Africa.
Well, Gabon's model was really a sustainable development model. We committed to the principle that we should set aside 30% of world's ecosystems for preservation. So Gabon currently is about 25% of land and ocean cover in protected areas. But being a country that has 88% forest cover, that's not going to preserve Gabon's forests. We have to think about what we do outside of the protected areas. And what we did was we transformed the forestry industry from an industry that degrades the forests and created very little value added for Gabon by starting timber processing in Gabon. And of course, that benefited from the AGOA agreement with the US, making exports to the US much, much easier. We found a way to make the forests outside the protected areas more valuable standing than dead, and valuable to people from all walks of life in Gabon. They create rural jobs for the rural people. They create peri-urban and urban jobs. And so that combination of conservation and wise use of natural resources, particularly processing the natural resources in Africa to give the industries that are developing in Africa a stake in the sustainability of the harvest, we think is a model that can be applied elsewhere. And we see it with all the investment done by the Arise company that started in Gabon, investing in Togo and Benin in processing cotton into clothing instead of exporting the raw cotton to China, processing beef in Chad, adding value, creating quality jobs in Africa. We think that model really is the way forward.
Professor Lee White is a former minister for water, forests, the sea and environment in Gabon. He spoke with me from Dubai, United Arab Emirates. In Namibia, a leading anti-graft campaigner says citizens want proof that public funds were not used to sponsor children of the president to travel to Dubai for the COP28 summit in Dubai. Job Ampundai, former mayor of the capital Windhoek and leader of Affirmative Repositioning, a political pressure group, also says explanations about the children's trip are not satisfactory. His remarks come after civil society, opposition groups and critics expressed outrage following reports that four children of the president were part of the government delegation to the climate summit. Responding to the criticisms, the government says President Hage Geingob and First Lady Madam Monica Geingob paid for the flight and accommodation of their children. For more reaction about the controversy, I reach Job Ampunda.
So these things happen because of systematic problems that we have. And there's always a debate that we have in Namibia whether the corruption is systematic or it's not. The president argue that no, corruption is not systematic, but this is a system, right? So if even the argument is not necessarily whether they took their family or not, their response is that no, they paid for their children to bring this trip. But what if, as say, there's somebody who studied geography at the University of Namibia and anywhere else who also wanted to be part of the delegation? Was such an opportunity granted to Namibians who want to go and they can pay for themselves to also be part of the delegation?
But Job, if his children were not state-funded, why is there a problem in Namibia?
Okay, let's assume that the children were funded by his own pocket. So then it would have been easy for you to produce the tickets, isn't it? The tickets can be verified independently. Did they fly on a different flight? What do we mean by state-funded? That's also the question. There are many things that are included in the trip. First of all, the visa fee. So did they stand in the queue like any other Namibian to get a visa? So where are they sleeping? Who's providing for their security? Because you have provided a ticket, but the person who's guarding your child is on the state, is getting the S&Ts and what and overtime from the state. Peter, are you then arguing to say because you paid your own bill and the state paid for the chef that cooked the food, are you now going to argue that the state didn't spend anything?
But the presidency is saying that allegations of corruption against the government or perhaps the president and his family are malicious and politically motivated, just to make the president and his government look very bad.
Well, we know as a matter of fact that they went with their children. There were also ministers that are responsible for environment on that trip. The minister also had an opportunity to bring his child and get to pay for their own child to also be with them there. We know that that's not the case. We equally know that they are not government officials. So basically, whether there are objective facts to this matter, those objective facts have nothing to do with whatever the articulation and spin doctoring thing that those guys want.
Are anti-corruption groups like yours and other Namibians calling for an investigation about this?
Civil society in Namibia is simply saying, okay, for us to believe you, if you are saying you paid the cost, then just release, isn't it? Release the release the ticket. I mean, if you have paid for your child, you bought a ticket, you can indicate the ticket, how you booked it. It will be easier. That's what we are saying for whatever it is. Now there's a unity of purpose. We are also saying there's a moral question, there's a corrupt question, and many other things, and many other questions that need to be able to be answered. At the systematic level, we see this, what the president did and the first family did, as part of systematic corruption. And we are also saying, for instance, in other jurisdictions such as Kenya and others, when you report a case to the Anti-Corruption Commission, after the investigation, the commission, in other words, various individuals come together and they take a decision on what should happen. In our country, only one guy who decides, the Director General of Anti-Corruption Commission, one guy decides that no, this is basically what has happened. And we're simply saying that we don't want to have a situation like that. We want reform of institutions that are fighting corruption. Because clearly, these cases will continue and continue and continue again. And of course, I'm not surprised. This wouldn't have been the first time something like this happened.
Job Ampunda is a former mayor of the capital Windhoek and leader of Affirmative Repositioning, a political pressure group. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments, or greetings. Dial the international code +1 then 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1 then 202-258-3076.
In Botswana, an international affairs researcher is warning of the security challenges facing a proposal to scrap passport requirements for citizens of Botswana and Zimbabwe. Solly Ramkomo, who is also a media personality, says Botswana citizens who reside near the border with Zimbabwe are not happy with the plan. This after Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa announced he is working with Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi on a plan to scrap passport requirements to allow for the free movement of citizens from both countries. Botswana has a similar arrangement with Namibia, where both countries now accept state-issued identification cards from each other. Solly Ramkomo tells me that some in Botswana are concerned that the plan could increase cross-border crime and threaten the country's territorial integrity.
I appreciate the free movement of people between countries as members of, regional bloc SADC. But at the same time, I believe that when we take such measures, we should take into consideration the security implications of doing so. Because when you use a passport is an internationally accepted document that have security features. When you go to the border, produce your passport, there's a database that can show whether the user of that passport is a red flag or not. And also the passport can show that you are entering Botswana at this particular date and you are going to come back on this particular date, because they want to introduce a situation where you use a national identity card. We call it an Omang. So it does not have security features. So it is going to cause problems.
But Solly, in the first place, most people who live along the borders are the same families. So this is just a way of trying right the continent, even within the SADC region, because this is what a lot of countries are trying to do across Africa.
Yes, that's why I say that I don't have any problem with the free movement of people, because we have relatives in Zimbabwe and they have relatives here. But at the same time, we should not be carried away by the excitement of unification of Africa and then we ignore security issues. Because right now, even though we have families on the other side, we have problems of illegal migration. So it is very important to keep law and order in the sense that when you use a legally and internationally accepted a document like a passport, it does not cause any harm.
When President Masisi spoke about for integration and for Zimbabweans to freely to and transact business in Botswana and back and forth, people along the border were displeased. What was their major concern? For which reason they were displeased with the president's statement recently?
The reason why they were not here is because of some of the things I mentioned. Because of the people along the borders, especially on the Botswana side, they are worried about illegal migrants who come into the country and cause problems. They are also worried about cross-border crime. So these are some of the issues, that cross-border crime like cattle rustling and the smuggling of counterfeit goods, smuggling of drugs, because people are worried about, the poor security management along the border. So now when you come up with something that will make it more simpler for people to move around without any documents that have security features to see who is a criminal, who is not, now people are right to get worried, because security is at the center of their minds, because they know they experience problems of illegal migration and cross-border crime firsthand because they're living along those borders.
Are they saying that the security institutions in Botswana and perhaps in Zimbabwe cannot step up or bolster security to address some of these challenges that you are talking about?
No, because our security agencies from both countries, they find it very difficult capacity-wise. They are not up to the task of preventing cross-border illegal migration, because our borders are very long and they are very porous with so many ungoverned spaces. But now when you try to introduce an identity card which does not have any security features, you are increasing the problem. That's the main concern. The police can see from your passport that you entered on this particular date and you are supposed to leave after this on this particular date. But for a national identity card, there's nothing that can show that you have overstayed or not.
Solly Ramkomo is an international affairs researcher. He spoke with me from Botswana's capital, Gaborone. The leader of the minority in the Ugandan parliament is calling for the unconditional release of all political prisoners In a petition to Parliament, Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is also calling for the government to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate human rights abuses. His remarks come after the opposition boycotted parliamentary activities. They say the government must commit to the respect of human rights and stop state institutions from being used to violate the rights of citizens. But critics say the demands are a publicity stunt to please opposition benefactors abroad. Attorney Mathias Mpuuga tells me the opposition in Parliament demands the respect and protection of the rights of citizens.
Well, the demand is premised on the information we have already gotten across from families and from various security agencies, namely that these people are being held by various state military and paramilitary agencies. And we know prisoners that have been appearing before the court-martial for more than 2 years, and the state has never bothered to investigate their cases to prosecute them, meaning that they are being held as political prisoners. They are actually being held on by the state as a way of exacting revenge on these people who are supporting the opposition. So our demand is that these are prisoners of conscience, and therefore they should be released without any further ado. The laws of Uganda are very clear. If you're not able to prosecute an accused and is on remand for 6 months, that person qualifies for automatic bail.
Well, but Matthias, critics of what you are saying and demanding are saying that the NUP appears to be telling its supporters not to respond or engage the police in their investigation into some of these human rights violations that you are talking about. So they are saying, on one hand, you can't say that the police or the state institutions are not doing their jobs while undermining their efforts.
That narrative has since been debunked. In my presentation to Parliament, I presented the evidence of the cooperation of families with the police and some of the evil proposals made by government agencies, including compensating them in the dark without coming clean of the whereabouts of their loved ones. The narrative of non-cooperation was debunked because there was evidence of these families reporting to the police. There was evidence of police correspondence with the State House, with a number of agencies of state. So it was being driven by those who are not willing to be accountable. So when we presented the evidence, there was no response to the evidence we presented. Nobody tried to impeach it, meaning that our evidence of cooperation stood, still stands.
Well, one of the demands I understand the opposition is making in Parliament is for the government to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate human rights violations. Now, this commission, the suggestion is that for a high court judge to preside over this commission. However, your critics are saying, on one hand, you are saying the judiciary has been captured by the government. So why do you go back to the government to say that they should appoint a judge to oversee a committee? They are saying that this is a double talk by the opposition and a publicity stunt just to appease your benefactors abroad.
First of all, I want anybody out there in their right senses to name our benefactors abroad. Our benefactors are citizens whose rights we are fighting for. Secondly, as long as we are part of Uganda, it's our duty to demand that the judiciary is left to operate with the independence prescribed in the law and what society expects. The judiciary obtains power from the people. Part of our demand of the judiciary is to work independently. So when we ask of a high court judge to preside over an inquest, it's actually the jury's out there in the judiciary to prove that they can work independently. And therefore, as long as we're in Parliament, it means we respect and want to restore the rule of law and the constitutional order. So it has nothing to do with our trust of the institution of the judiciary or the lack of it.
The government has denied sharply that the human rights record in the country is one of the poorest in the world, and that it has committed, it has explained, and it will continue to respect human rights and ensure that Ugandans are protected, irrespective of the criticism being leveled against it.
But the evidence available says otherwise. We laid bare the record of the regime in terms of the levels of intolerance to political opposition and dissent, how they have been terrorizing the media and scattering civic space. We have tabled the number of civilians killed because of their political views, those that are missing because they espouse different political views. What more do you want? Do they want a comparison with Afghanistan? Do they want a comparison with Iran? I think the jury is out there.
Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is the leader of the minority in the Ugandan parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. We'll be right back. Tanzania's Prime Minister Kassim Majaliwa is dismissing speculation about the health and whereabouts of Vice President Philip Mpango. This after saying the Vice President is on official assignment overseas. His remarks come after the Vice President, who was originally scheduled to attend an event this week, was instead represented by a cabinet minister. Local media reports say Mpango has not been seen in public for over a month. Some citizens are expressing concern about his whereabouts, especially since he has yet to comment about the recent flooding and landslides in the Hanang region. For more reaction and analysis, I reach Faraja Lugome. He is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam.
This concern, I think, started after 2 weeks of disappearance. People started to speculate, where is he and what are the news about his whereabouts? So people were eager to hear from the government officers who are responsible for these issues, especially government spokespersons, but all of them kept silent. That created more speculations about where he is. And unfortunately, no official response from the vice president's office, neither from the president's office about where he is. But some of us, because we know some of the communication officers in the government, we keep on asking them personally, would you please tell us where the vice president is?
Prime Minister Kassim Majaliwa has warned against what he says is speculation, saying the vice president was out of the country for official duties. But has this quietened the rumors or the speculations on social media platforms?
No, it has not quietened, but it has a little bit relieved the tension that people had. And what you see, the Prime Minister, unfortunately, people have some memories about his statements when Magufuli died. By the time Magufuli died, he made a public statement that the president is very fit physically and mentally, and he will appear in public soon. And unfortunately, one day later, the president announced the death of President Magufuli. Now, this time when the prime minister said the vice president is abroad for official visit, people were a little bit anxious, a little bit skeptical, because they have the previous record about his statement concerning the public disappearance of the former president, Magufuli. So people were divided. Some were said, okay, let's be skeptical. Maybe the prime minister has learned the lesson of the previous miscalculated statement. Maybe this time he means the truth. But some says, no, maybe it is now like the tradition of the government of not speaking the truth about the public figures. And so people were divided. But a little bit, some people had some hopes because of his statement, thinking maybe he's outside. But people ignored his assertion that he's for official visit. In fact, the health of the vice president deteriorated when he was affected by COVID-19 in 2020.
Raja, this is not the first time the vice president, in 2021, he dismissed death rumors. And he came out in public. He coughed. People are questioning why. Is it that he has to always defend whether he is ill or not?
When he was forced to appear public, it was the efforts of the former president to clear the rumors that he's still alive. But in fact, by that time, he was seriously hit by COVID-19. And the president was against the idea of COVID-19 by then. So he wanted to create an image. By then, he was the Minister for Finance. He wanted to bring the image to the public that, no, there's no COVID and the Minister for Finance is alive. But in fact, he was seriously hit by COVID-19. But this time, I think they have chosen to not to say in public that the vice president is sick and he's hospitalized abroad, but no one is told where he is or hospitalized. Since then, up to now, no one knows where he is hospitalized, but we believe he is hospitalized somewhere abroad.
Faraja Lugume is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first,
there are days I wake up and I pinch myself. You're with me.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
And I'm scared, yeah, I'm still scared. That is all a dream. Cause you still look perfect as days go by. Even the worst ones, you make me smile. I'd stop the world if it gave us time. Cause when you love someone, you open up your heart. When you love someone, you make room. If you love someone and you're not afraid to lose them, you probably never loved someone like I do. You probably never loved someone like I do. When you say the way I make you feel, everything becomes so real. Don't be scared, no, don't be scared. Cause you're all I need. And you still look perfect as days go by. Even the worst ones, someone like I do.
jingle bells square in the frosty air. What a bright time, it's the right time to rock the night away. Jingle bell time is a swell time to go gliding in the one horse sleigh. Giddy up, jingle horse, pick up your feet, jingle up around the clock. Mix and mingle in the jingling feet, that's the jingle bell rock.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bell chime in the jingle bell time. Dancing and prancing in jingle bell square.
Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't
And that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nicole Peters, engineer Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the white chicken does not realize its age. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.